it's time for Culture Shocks with your host, Barry Lynn.
All right, and welcome to today's edition of Culture Shocks. This is Barry Lynn. The 50s, the 1950s, a golden era. We hear that it is. I lived through a lot of it. I mean, I actually lived through all of it, but I'm not sure I was conscious of some of it. And this was great. I mean, it was a golden era. Now, it wasn't a golden era if you were a woman or the girl across the alley from me. We know that now. It wasn't great for African Americans, but we didn't have too many African Americans living in my city growing up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. But for white men, I mean, it was perfect. I mean, I don't quite remember that, but I'm told that if you watch Mad Men, which I actually try not to do, except sometimes it's on in hotels when I'm traveling and it's there. And I mean, it must have been a great time. I must have missed some things that were going on, particularly in my father's job as a salesman for slag, which is a byproduct of the production of steel, as he worked as a salesman at the Bethlehem Steel. But wait a minute. Wait, maybe it wasn't a golden era. Even for men, not a golden era. That's what Susan Jacoby says. She's always with us every time she comes out with a book. A great thinker about the culture and the history of times, in this case, the history and times of what she calls the last men on top. Susan Jacoby, welcome again to the show.
Oh, I'm very glad to be back. And I should say that I picked the title for that, and the double entendre is meant.
It should be.
It's intended to be in all senses of the word.
Well, let's talk about the years where we did have these last men on top, or at least some people think they were on top. What years are we talking about?
Well, what we're really talking about, what I mean by the last men on top, is first of all the generation that came of age during World War II, which would be your parents.
Yep.
And mine. And I also include in this book some of the younger men born during the Depression who sort of inherited a little bit of that power. You see them on Mad Men as the younger men.
Right.
In the office. Also, the men who were really running things at the top of the firm were the World War II generation. And then there is the generation born of depression that came of age, actually, in the 1950s. And so they saw the last part of men's absolutely unquestioned domination at work. But the difference between them and the World War II generation is, in the 1960s, when they were still in their 30s, they had to deal with quite a changing.
Indeed.
World. But in any case, the point of my book is that things weren't all that great for men in those days either.
It is true, and before we get to why that's true, though, when you talk about the last men on top, even with double entendres removed, if you look at the percentage of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies today, for example, women are a minuscule percentage of that. So maybe the last men on top, secretly, they're still on top, and you and I missed it.
Well, this is of course true that at the very top level of business, women are still vastly underrepresented. But in a way, I mean, I think we'll get to that. But in a way, that's another conversation. But the presence of women and the influence of women at the level just below the top and in the middle, I mean, there's no comparison between that. And not just the 1950s, by the way,
mm-hmm.
but the first half of the 1960s.
Right.
People talk about the 60s incorrectly as though they were all
that's right.
one decade. But really, the first half of the 1960s, in terms of everyday life, was much more like the 1950s and the late 1940s than it was like what came later on.
And would you say it's fair to characterize that collection of pieces of two decades and all the 50s as a time when people in general in this country, certainly white America, grew up in families where dad worked and mom, quote, didn't work, which meant she, quote, stayed at home and did all the work there?
Correct. The covenant was the man earned the living in the outside world. The woman the woman took care of everything domestic, and the price of the covenant for women, it's been very well told, that story has been very well told by feminism, was the suppression of worldly ambition. When I was growing up, and I grew up in a suburb of Lansing, Michigan, which was then the headquarters of Pontiac, tied to the auto industry the way Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, yep, was tied to the steel industry. If someone in middle-class life said she works about a married woman, it wasn't meant she did any of the work women did inside her home. It meant she was unlucky enough to have a husband who was a bad provider, mm-hmm, and therefore she had to go out to work in an office because he didn't make enough money. So we know that the price to women was not only that you won't really have a chance to earn your own money whether you want to or not. The price to men, which has been less talked about and certainly was less talked about at the time of feminism, was that was the thing that if they failed at, they failed at everything.
Right.
This power that you see on Mad Men, you know what Mad Men depicts? And I actually like Mad Men.
Yeah.
It depicts the 1% of its day. The lives of most men was not being paid what top advertising men on Madison Avenue were being paid. It was not having the time and the money to rent fancy hotel rooms for their girlfriends and apartments for their serious mistresses. I say this in my book,
yep,
that even if my father had had the desire for routine adultery, he worked so hard he wouldn't have had the time. And furthermore, my mother, who, like many women of her time, took care, you know, my father handed over his paycheck,
sure,
to my mother,
course,
and this was common.
Of course.
If my mother had seen an unexplained expenditure for hotel rooms,
yeah,
she'd have noticed.
Yeah, there have been a lot of questions over the casserole. Now, when you talk about this stress, though, particularly of that person who is the breadwinner, no two breadwinners, unless, you know, and there's another phrase that occasionally one would hear is, my husband allows me to work.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. There was that, too.
but the guys, there's an enormous amount of stress if you know that you're providing virtually the entire income for the family and you get laid off. What would you do? You'd have nothing to fall back on. Not unlike, as you point out in your book, The Last Man on Top, what single parents, i.e. single women, do today.
That's right. And that's why, look, when you think about the recession we are still living through and have been living through since 2008, think apart from how many homes have been lost, think if things were like they were in the 50s when almost no middle-class married women worked. I stress that middle class. Poor women have always worked.
Right.
Women in the bottom fifth and the bottom two-fifths work then. It was women, and women at the top didn't work either, but women in the middle class, that part of middle class status was that your wife didn't work outside
That's
her home.
Right.
But think today, if so few women worked, how many more homes would have been lost? The man, if he got laid off, and growing up in a state that was dependent on the auto industry, this was a constant worry. Think about what happens if there is no fallback, if there is no woman even making less than the man, but still making something.
What do you think is the rough percentage of income brought in by women in middle-class families today? I mean, it's a broad
today,
swath.
Actually, I know.
Yep.
In the middle fifth of American families, and this is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it's about 44%.
Whoa. 44%.
In the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
Poor women bring in much more.
Yep.
And rich women bring in much less. You know, there's all
sure.
this talk about,
yeah.
Believe me, in the 1%, the majority of married women do not work.
No, they do not. And we'll talk about the political ramifications of that, including in the last election cycle, and try to figure out what men did when they went to work, say, in 1952. We're talking to Susan Jacoby, author of the new book, The Last Men on Top. We'll be back for more of Culture Shocks. All right, we are back, and we're talking to the wonderful Susan Jacoby. Many, many books that we've talked to her about on this show. Free Thinkers, as she wrote the book The Age of American Unreason. She just wrote a book about Robert Ingersoll, a great, sadly forgotten hero of rationality in America. And now is out with an e-book called The Last Men on Top. Okay, so Susan, I love Japanese culture. I don't understand it. A lot of it is, it's charming, but I don't quite get it. But it has people, many people, that are called salarymen. They get into a company, they rise possibly to the level of inefficiency, if the Peter principle is right, and they just stay there. Now, I do not remember my father that I mentioned was a salesman of stone and slag at the Bethlehem Steel Company. I don't ever remember him considering leaving Bethlehem Steel. And it was only after his death that my mother told me how heartbroken my father had been when he didn't get a promotion at least 15 years before he left the company. He just stayed where he was. Is that common?
Well, that was at that time. First of all, people moved around less geographically. Moving away geographically from where you were was much less common than it is today. But in general, I would say our parents were formed by the Depression. That was another reason for it too. That what you had, even though it might not be very satisfactory, was worth more than the unknown. Now, my father was an accountant, and eventually he worked for a horrible man who's also dead, so I can say what I want.
Sure. Yes, those libel laws don't cover the dead.
Right. Everybody in this book is dead. So I I'm sure that's one of the reasons that I wrote it now, as opposed to when people who could be perhaps hurt by some of the observations with it. Nobody is alive who is in this book. But then my father ultimately, after years of working for this man, he wanted to sell a business, and my father was able to buy this small accounting business in Lansing, Michigan. My dad told me when I was starting out my journalistic career at the Washington Post, I then married the Post Moscow correspondent, and I wrote my first book, which was about Russia when we were in Moscow. And my dad sent me a letter when I was in Moscow saying, one of the things I really envy about you is that you love what you do. And I had never thought, I had literally never given by the way, I apologize to your audience for using that word literally. I've been inspected. It does not need to be used here.
It does not.
I never gave a thought while I was growing up to whether my father liked what he did at all. And I don't think he did either, really. This was what he had a talent for mathematics. This was what turned up very early in his life. And he told me later on, after I had returned from Moscow, that he would have liked to have been a high school history teacher, and he would have been good at it. He was sort of a natural teacher. He was interested in history. But when the war was over, he was in the Army, and he was not overseas because he was blind in one eye, so he was not allowed in combat. But he met my mom in Chicago when Dad was stationed in the Quartermaster Corps, being an accountant for them.
Of course.
Chicago was then, it was the center of the meatpacking industry, and so it was a very important place for sending all the spam that the Army consumed. But when the war was over, my dad had a one-year-old child. And, you know, that was that, basically, as far as he was concerned. He continued as an accountant with many things I describe in the book, and that's what he stayed in. And I think this is another thing. My mother, who is a very talented woman, and eventually, after my brother and I were college age, went back to work in my father's business to straighten out. My father was an excellent boss, but a terrible administrator. My mother took over the administrative part of it, and they had a mom-and-pop business then.
Right.
And my mother would have been happier working. But, you know, they did what was expected of them. And as a result, my father never really had any choices in life, such as, you know, even young people with all the trouble they're having finding work today, they don't think of themselves as being tied down to one thing. in the way that our parents' generation really did.
Yeah, let me add.
As I say in the book, when I think about my father, when I think about my childhood, I think about the sound of tires rolling over rock salt in our icy driveway, which if you grew up in the Midwest in the winter, you remember it. Tax season was January, February, March. My father left the house at 4:30 in the morning every day because 80-hour weeks was what he had to work to make the business work.
Yeah.
Now,
your
you tell
father,
me how much power somebody like that has.
Yeah, zero.
Zero.
And you also quote in the book from the great Studs Terkel, his book Working, about where he just interviewed people who worked. I mean, he was as close to a person who actually understood what
Absolutely.
It was. And here, you know, you've got stories of people who just say, you know, this is what I do is a waste of time. I mean, it means absolutely nothing. I don't remember my father weighing in ever on the question of whether his job was, by his standards, important. I know that there were things he wished he had done, but he didn't say, I'm doing nothing of value. Now, question about this generation. Is it unfair to suggest, for example, that today's young men, those who have jobs, think every job is of vital importance, which is why it is impossible for them not to answer their phone even in the middle of a movie theater, or that they have to text while driving because they have to be in touch. It's so vital. I have to talk to somebody. Are they doing the wrong thing on the other end?
I don't know. I don't like to make judgments about other generations, but I will tell you one of the reasons that I wrote this ebook. And that is that right now we're in the midst of a periodic renewal of debate about the roles of men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is, and it's always said, well, and not only were salaries better then, but a family could live on one salary, as if that were the sum total of everything. What I'm thinking is this, that the generation of people now in their late 20s and 30s really, they are under a lot of pressures that my parents' generation perhaps weren't, not the least of them being there are certain choices now which didn't even occur to my parents, like that my mother could have worked and would have enjoyed working. As she said many times to me in her old age, she would have been a lot happier if she had had a job.
Exactly.
She didn't like being around little kids. She said she really liked being a mother the better the older we got.
Well, many people feel that way in every generation.
But the thing is that to have a kind of false nostalgia for the days when one salary took care of everything. First of all, it simply wipes out the huge unpaid contribution. It wasn't just that one salary took care of everything. It's that the labor of women was taken completely for granted.
Oh, absolutely. Taken for granted, accepted, and then culturally at least, and sometimes within families, totally discounted. We got to take a little break. When we come back, more with Susan Jacoby. Her new e-book is The Last Men on Top. And we are going to talk about sex, but before that, we're going to talk about the regularity of life, say, 1955. We'll be back. All right, we are back right here on Culture Shocks. I'm your host, Barry Lynn, and we're talking to Susan Jacoby, the author of at least 10 books, and now out with a new e-book called The Last Men on Top. You know, Susan, you were talking about your dad. You could hear the tires crunching on the salt and on the icy pavements in Michigan when he would leave during tax season, those 3 months of heavy tax season work, as he was as an accountant. Crunching the tires under the tires, and you'd hear that in the morning. There was a regularity to my life like that. You said after tax season, your father always came home at 6 o'clock, and that was a half hour before dinner. In my case, he came home at 5:25, unless he stopped at the candy store, because he would stop at the candy store and he would say, oh, I ran over some orange trees, and then he'd have orange slice candy, and it would be a big deal. Then he would have a glass of sherry every night, not anything else, always sherry. When we went on vacations, 1 week to the mountains, my dad liked that. 1 week to the seashore, my mom liked that. The same restaurants, the same hotels. We didn't, quote, go out to eat. We ate at the same places every day for a decade when I traveled with them. Now, what does that sense of we're going to do it the same way all the time? What was their fear? You at one point said you could ruin your life by being too experimental.
I think that was a feeling. I also think that was why there was such a terrible cultural clash in the late 60s between this generation, our parents' generation, and our generation. Because the whole idea, for instance, of staying in school, of not going to work right away,
mm-hmm.
or if you stayed in school, of going to graduate school instead of going to, say, a law school or a medical school, which then would lead inevitably, as it does not necessarily today,
right.
to a really good job. I think that again, I think part of it was simply the depression that, look, my parents had both had a lot of turmoil in their life. My dad had to drop out of college in 1932 because his family lost all its money in the stock market, helped along by his father being a compulsive gambler.
Yeah.
My mother's family lost their house in suburban Chicago during the Depression. So these were obviously formative experiences for many of the people of our parents' generation. And also, just to follow up on what we were talking about earlier, the other thing is one of the prices these men paid is not enough time with the families they were working so hard to support.
That's right.
My father didn't see us basically for 3 months of the year. In the summer, yes,
sure.
when he was able to come home earlier. But it's really true. It's always had the cliche, nobody said I didn't work enough on their deathbed.
Right.
And my father did when he died of lung cancer in 1986. He said to me many times that the greatest regret of his life was he hadn't spent enough time with my brother and me when we were growing up.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any, as you've read, as you've produced this book and as people start to read it, is there any remote example of this kind of reaction from feminists? I mean, you're certainly a strong figure in the feminist movement and have been for a long time, but did any feminists look at this and go, you know, I wonder, is this another kind of pity the man apologetic?
I don't know. I mean, I've shown it to some of my close friends in feminism, and some of them like it and some of them don't. And not surprisingly, what divides people about this is not whether you're a feminist or not a feminist so much as what kind of a family did you grow up in?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of memories did you have of your father? It is often said that feminist women were often raised by strong feminist mothers, which I think it's true. But there's also something that is also true about a lot of feminists I know, which is they had unusually close relationships with their fathers, too. And they had fathers who encouraged their ambitions.
Right.
I'm sure there must be feminists who had horrible fathers who beat them up and so on. But many feminists had fathers who were unusually supportive of their daughters' ambitions for that time. And I think, by the way, there is one good thing. I hate Tom Brokaw's expression, the
greatest
generation,
right.
Because, frankly, I don't think it makes you the greatest just because you were the right age to fight in the last
right.
war America remembers as a good war. But one of the accomplishments of this generation was it is the first generation to send, if they were sending anybody to college, they sent their daughters as well as their sons,
right.
which was not true in the previous generation. We are now used to both the girls and the boys going to school. But that was not the case when my parents were
sure.
growing up, and it only became the case in the late 1950s and 1960s as the children of the war generation matured. My father's generation sent both daughters and sons to school.
Yeah, that's extraordinary, and it's easy to forget that. It's easy to overlook that.
I forgot it till I started writing this book.
Yeah, speaking. let me go back to this greatest generation because I've always been troubled by that, and I remember talking to Tom when the book first came out. But in the final chapter of this ebook of yours, you do talk about some very great people in your life, men, great mentors who happen to be men. For example, some, not all, but some of the people at the Washington Post, your first place of major employment. What made them special or important, or maybe even if they were doing things or saying things or promoting your interests, and that was seen by others as out of the mainstream, they were very special people.
Well, look, first of all, of course, there's special people. There's special people in every generation.
Sure.
There are people who move it along. I mean, things don't, you know, the social change doesn't spring out of nowhere at all. But and it was not unusual for women to have male mentors, obviously, because there weren't female mentors to have then. There
sure.
weren't any women except for Katharine Graham at the Washington Post
right.
in any positions
That's
of
right.
power when I was a young reporter. But the first really important man in my life, my professional life, was a journalism professor named George Huff III at Michigan State. And what he did for me was invaluable. He said to me, "You have got to get a job working for a newspaper in college, because if what you want to do is be a newspaper reporter, it's going to be three times as hard for you as a woman than it is for a man. You have got to have three times as much experience when you get out of here." And boy, was he right. It was the whole collection of clippings, which used to be called a string book by young reporters, that got me my job at the Washington Post. And oddly enough, it had not occurred to me when I was of college age that really I was going to have all that much of a problem because
right,
I was
right.
a woman, which you can say I was stupid and naive, but there were a lot of women who were stupid and naive that way. Yeah. I think probably one reason it hadn't occurred to me is my father made me think I was so special that I never really thought about, well, how special is that going
to
look out
to
in
somebody
the, you
know, else.
The one thing Mad Men is right about is the way that women were treated in the office.
No, exactly. Yeah, of all the words I could possibly imagine about anything, anyone thinking about you, stupid and naive are not two of those words.
But I was naive then, and
yeah.
one of the things this professor did was he told me in very explicit terms, "You're going to have to do a lot more than men your age." And then I went to the Washington Post, where men my age and experience were paid at least $40 a week more than I was
wow.
because they, quote, had to support a family, even when they didn't, by the way.
Of course. But it was
even
a good
when
theory.
They were single.
It was a good theory.
Just as I was.
Okay. We're going to come back and wrap up this conversation with Susan Jacoby. Her new ebook is called The Last Men on Top, a refreshing new look at the pressures and the stresses, not just on women, well chronicled during the late 40s, early throughout the 50s, early 60s, until a general revolution occurs in the thinking about male and female. And yes, as promised, we will get to the men on top idea. We'll talk about the sexual command economy. Wasn't that's what you see on Mad Men, not what Susan or I saw in our own families. But we'll chat about that when we return right here on Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. All right, we're talking about the gold, or maybe it was only silver or bronze, or maybe it was slag generation, late 40s, 50s, early 60s, for men who allegedly ran the world and knew it, but as it turns out, they were incredibly stressful times, and some of those are the very things that I remember in my own family and that Susan Jacoby is chronicling in her new book, The Last Men on Top. Now, of course, it is a bit of a play on words. And men, the phrase you use is a sexual command economy. We make all the money. We can do anything you want. We can make you do anything you want. You are subservient to us. I don't remember my parents, except my father, when I asked, and it was pretty specific, I'd have asked pretty specifically, ever talking about sex. I was aware that sex occurred. I was also aware that they had double beds. The idea of getting a queen size, king size foam mattress mattress covered bed. Unthinkable. I do know that my father used to go see an occasional, quote, foreign film, right, which was sometimes it was just Sophia Loren. But he would say, he'd use words like it was a little racy. That kind, but beyond that, I never imagined a sexual command structure in the Lynn household.
Well, look, first of all, the only thing I could tell you about my parents' sex life is that unlike most Roman Catholics of their generation, they did practice birth control. My brother and I were practically the only kids at St. Thomas Aquinas School who didn't have 5 to 10 siblings.
Oh, geez.
And I assume that because my parents had only 2 children, that they did not follow the church's doctrine on birth control.
Yeah, or they were very careful mathematically using calendars.
I doubt that very much somehow. Knowing my mother and my father, they were both very sort of vibrant personalities. I don't see them looking. In fact, I know because I talked to my mother about it later on in her life. When people tend to become much more frank about these things,
exactly.
But in general, the thing about men had more freedom, especially if they had the money and to exercise that freedom and the professional power. You know, my father certainly didn't, even if he'd wanted to. But there's another thing. I mean, when I began my sex life, it was still in this mythological world of the early 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
The birth control pill was invented when I was 19. And by the way, I mean, one of the things you had to worry about in this, again, the sexual bargain was simple. The man was supposed to know what he was doing. If he was young, he certainly didn't.
No.
And the woman was supposed to be innocent. And this kind of mutual ignorance, which I remember from the start of my adult quote-unquote sex life, did not necessarily lead to pleasure for anyone.
No.
And I remember when I read about the birth control pill in a news magazine in Lansing when I was 18, and I thought, I wonder if there's any way that I could get that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a doctor, and I lied. I said I was engaged, and my wedding night was just around the corner, and what about this new pill that I've heard about and so on?
Yep.
And I don't believe for a minute that this doctor bought this story. But he did. And again, this is a man of my father's generation,
sure.
And I'm sure the idea of someone his daughter's age having sex must have been disturbing to him. But he wrote me that prescription. And I think this is one of the many men I think of. And I think for those in that generation who were great, it's that they could see, the best of them could see beyond, a little bit beyond the times in which they actually lived and stretched themselves. This doctor could have been a bastard.
Of course.
He was the only doctor, really, for college-age patients who wasn't part of the campus health service, which you would never go to.
Of course
campus
not.
Health service was a contradiction. It was like a three-word oxymoron.
Exactly.
but he could have been a bastard and said no to all those girls who came to him and asked about the pill. I can't possibly have been the only one.
Of course not.
But this kind of a thing, you know, for instance, in which how often when I was growing up did I hear the phrase, they had to get married?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what, yes, undoubtedly there were men, particularly in large cities, who were impervious to social pressure. But mostly what a young man did when he got a girl pregnant in a place like Lansing, and it was always he got a girl pregnant.
Of course.
You know, the idea that she could have anything to do with it, it didn't enter into the thing.
Of course not.
Was he married her?
Sure.
And that marriages, you know, that this is a great start in a way for marriage. So I think this looking back, you know, people have told me how glamorous Mad Men looks. Well, what really is glamorous about women unmarried women not having access to contraception, about men supposedly having to trick them into sex, and women having to pretend they're more innocent than they are? I don't remember that as glamorous.
No. That's why, Susan, I'm a Walking Dead fan and not a Mad Men fan. because there's so little sex among zombies.
I kind of like Walking Dead, too.
Yeah, I know, I know. Well, you know, there's always room for one more zombie book. So this, you know, the kind of phallocracy, the idea that sexual prowess of men, which, of course, they didn't have, as you point out. One of the reasons they didn't have it is because we didn't teach sex education. Nobody knew too much, or they lied about what they thought they knew. And I remember a study, reading a study in the 70s about sex education programs in the 60s, where they asked students in various schools that had a sex education program whether the students had, in fact, had a sex education program in high school. And 50% or more of the students said, nope, we didn't have it. They did have it, but it was so benign, so silly, so lukewarm, they didn't even know they were experiencing sex education.
Yeah, usually it was about pollinating plants.
Yes. Yeah, fungi.
Well, usually it was hard to figure out what they were driving at. but actually, this term phallocracy, which is, of course, a ridiculous term, it appears and is not very much used in the 1970s, but it meant the overall power of men. And I think one reason, my 23-year-old niece, for instance, was stunned by this story about having to lie to get birth control. Well, that's the thing. What I really would like is if people in their 20s would read this, because I think, you know, I think because there are problems in every generation, and there are really huge problems with the young today, one of them being that they're graduating with hundreds of thousands of in college debts. Damn. And can't get jobs. I think that, and certainly in two-earner families, there are problems of time that are different from in my parents' generation, but there's a tendency when you confront the problems, which are not always the same that every generation have, of thinking that something else was very different. And what I was sort of saying in that chapter is, well, how would you like this? You know, how would you like to live this way? The fact that there are problems with the changing balance of power between men and women today doesn't things mean that
no.
things were better or easier back then.
No, and I want people to understand, too. I mean, there are a lot of stories that, of course, we I wouldn't want to tell every story in the book because I want people to get the e-book, The Last Man on Top, Susan Jacoby's newest book. You talk about your dad and books, and I just wanted to ask you one thing. Reflect on one thing. My dad read a lot, but he, like your father, he'd be busy, and he couldn't get to all the books. You have a wonderful story about William Shire's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and how your dad suggested you read it, and then he reads it. But there were a lot of books that would come from the Book of the Month Club, for example. My dad just wouldn't be able to read it.
Of
course. Now, I didn't read the same books my kids read. I mean, once I got through the let's read this series of books to you, I took my kids to movies a lot. And I wonder, what do parents do today? Do they play first-person shooter games on the video screen with their kids, or is that only Wayne LaPierre? What's the comparable connection today with reading and book discussions
well,
that you and I have?
It's not as strong in the same way that books are not as important in our culture today.
That's
as
right.
They were then.
No.
And what middle class people don't have is Book of the Month Club.
No.
They have a computer and they do have video games, and it's not that no parents parents still read to their children before their children can read.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a matter of families particularly. Books are not as important in our culture today.
That's
people
right.
don't consider them as vital. So naturally, if the parents themselves don't read as much as, let's say, my parents read all
That's
the time,
right.
even though my mother had much more
sure.
time for reading than my father. And this is a lot of people. Philip Roth has just written about this, too.
I know. And Philip Roth, unfortunately, on Philip Roth, Susan Jacoby, we must end this conversation. But I thank you so much, as always, for being on the show. The book is The Last Man on Top, available as an e-book. You've been listening to Culture Shocks. I'm Barry Lynn. We'll talk again.
This edition of Culture Shocks has been produced by Diane Robinson, engineered by Dwayne Davis, and the Genesis Communication Network technical staff. Visit us online at cultureshocks.com.